Support for the World's Podcast comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ, or Curious Quotient, through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/the world.
From KPBS in San Diego, we're On the Border, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. All this hour, we're focusing on the U.S.-Mexico border, and we meet a couple of Border Patrol agents on the lookout for smugglers.
It's a constant battle. The smugglers are going to try to come across and cut a hole in its fence because they can't climb it, or it's harder to climb than to try to cut a hole through it.
Also, new arrivals to the border region bring different eating habits to one San Diego school cafeteria.
I would eat the chicken, and my body would have a reaction to it mentally because what my body is consuming is not halal.
Plus, the new cultural face of Tijuana, foodies, galleries, and live music.
Right now, I think it's a great moment to be in Tijuana.
That's all coming up in a special Global Nation edition of The World. Thank you for being with us on this special Global Nation edition of the show. As I said, I'm in San Diego today, looking south at the U.S.-Mexican border. I've got the world's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, with me, and we'll be telling these stories for the next hour today, Monica. It's an hour we're devoting to life along the border, specifically this border, about a 20-minute car ride away from where we're speaking. This much-talked-about dividing line between two countries, the U.S. and Mexico.
Yeah, when we talk about Global Nation, there's no better place to be than right here at the U.S.-Mexico border with California and Tijuana. And this week, we spent time crossing the border like so many people do here. And we've also been on the other side where people are facing huge challenges when it comes to coming into the United States, staying in the United States. And we'll be talking about these stories today on The World.
Yeah, we were at the border just the other day, the busiest border crossing in the world, we were told. 300,000 people per day. That's extraordinary.
Right. You experienced what a lot of people here experience every day, which is coming from Mexico back into the United States or vice versa and waiting up to 3 hours to make that border crossing by foot. This is something people are used to doing every day in this part of the world, but I don't think that your average American even knows that this happens.
I had no patience for it.
Right. Well, you did dig into some churros on the way.
That helped. We've also got stories of the culture along the border, art and architecture, food and music today, that flow from this dividing line between the U.S. And Mexico, and the kind of natural cross-pollination that happens along any frontier.
And Marco, you also met Mexicans who fought in the U.S. military, several deployed to wars abroad, and they were deported, and we met them in Mexico, and we're going to hear about their cases, their attempts to try and enter the United States and become citizens here.
That's coming up in the second half of the show, but let's start things off at that border. Some people call it a wall, but just to be clear, here it is a big steel fence. No matter what you call it, though, this structure is the physical barrier that runs for long stretches of the approximately 2,000-mile border between the U.S. and Mexico. It's become a symbol of many things, as we know, a symbol of immigration, a symbol of the rhetoric to stop immigrants from coming here, and it's also symbolic of the absence of any meaningful immigration reform right now. Instead of symbolism, though, we wanted to see it up close. So, Monica, you arranged for us to take a drive along the border, on the border, in fact, with two veteran agents for the U.S. Border Patrol.
I'm Senior Patrol Agent Lee Bahar, and I've been with the United States Border Patrol, and this will be my 28th year.
I'm Supervisory Border Patrol Agent Daryl Reed, and I've been with the Border Patrol for about 23 and a half years.
And is it correct to say that you're among the most veteran Border Patrol agents in this part of California?
Yes, and the Border Patrol as a whole.
Okay, Monica, before we go any further, describe this fence.
Well, it's 15 feet high, concertina wire all along the top, and it would be tough for anybody to scale. But as we saw, there are attempts.
It's a constant battle that the smugglers are going to try to come across and cut a hole in its fence because they can't climb it, or it's harder to climb than to try to cut a hole through it.
So, what do people use to cut this fence? Because this is a steel mesh, right?
They can get that type of equipment to cut this fence in a Home Depot in Mexico. They're going to come and try to do this as quick as possible because they got to get through. So they're going to come across, punch the hole through it, and then start to cut and try to do it as quick as they can. And you can see there's several places that they've made that attempt to try to get through that fence.
Agents Behar and Reed also told us about one of the more publicized challenges they deal with, the smuggling tunnels. You remember, Monica, that's when Agent Behar pointed across a fence to Mexico to show us where one tunnel, probably, 400 yards long, began.
You see a yellow building, how many yards is that? It started right there, and then they dug a tunnel right underneath us right here that comes into the U.S. side, because this is U.S. territory we're standing on right here. And then it went all the way across beyond this fence here, and you see that building right there, that warehouse right there, that's where the tunnel ended. And that's what we call one of our super tunnels, because they had lighting in there, they had railroad system in there.
So then we continued west toward the Pacific Ocean along this five-mile stretch of road, paved road, going through no man's land, and then stopped and got out at a steep, winding part of the road. So, Agent Reed, you call this spot Smuggler's Gulch. Why is that?
This was a big smuggling area. This gulch goes all the way to the road, and we've done a lot of construction here, diverting the water that comes through here, fencing. Then they tore down the sides of the canyon walls, filled in this gulch, made this what we're standing on, and put a road that you can drive across. Because back in the early 90s, if we were here doing this right now, I could guarantee you, you'd have seen aliens, at least several, just standing here in the time we've been here. And as we've been here now, have you guys seen anybody? This is a result of it.
So do you think a fence should be built all the way to Brownsville, Texas, to the Gulf of Mexico, encompassing the entire U.S.-Mexico border?
Where you can put a fence that is viable and it makes sense, yes, you should put a fence. There's some areas that you can't because of the terrain. Like here, Smuggler's Gulch, there's some areas that just doesn't make sense. And there's some areas that are just expanses of desert. It doesn't make sense to have a fence there. It's just a waste of taxpayers' money.
What about the notion that we see at the Statue of Liberty, give us, you're tired, you're hungry? That's all you encounter in terms of people coming up across the border, tired and hungry people. How do you feel about that?
I guess both of us are trying to jump at the answer to this one. We do see some people in the lower standards of life trying to make this this transition to the United States. The good thing about the United States is you got to take into account is there is a process, and to respect those people who have went through the correct process, someone's got to make sure that everything's done correctly, and someone has to do this job. And that's what we're doing.
And we ended our tour with the border agents at the southwesternmost part of the United States, where the border fence meets the sea, the Pacific Ocean.
That's right. The fence goes into the Pacific Ocean about 150 feet. And even here, the U.S. Border Patrol has to play whack-a-mole with smugglers and migrants, and they sink the fence pylons deep into the ocean bedrock.
We still get people on the jet skis that try to come across.
Even though you have Border Patrol right here, they're going to still try?
Yeah, and they're doing it at night most of the time, and they think we can't see. And we even had people with the surfboards they would put their drugs on top of the surfboard and push the surfboard and try to come up north.
All those problems with smugglers seem to just fade away, though. As we walked down the beach, that's where we met some boys who were on the Mexican side of the fence. We were on the U.S. side of the fence, talking to them through the narrow openings in the steel mesh. They had just come out of the ocean where they'd been swimming, just kids out for some fun. And that's when, despite all the practical arguments for a fence, I experienced for myself the sad reality of the structure that divides countries and people. You spoke with those kids, Monica. What did they tell you?
I did. All of them. They all live right there, right next to the fence. And I asked them why they think it exists.
Para que no haya problemas contra mexicanos, contra estadounidenses.
And this one kid said it's so that Mexicans and people in the United States won't have any problems. He also told me that when he turns 15, his family plans to send him to the United States.
Yeah, wow, incredible. So our ride along with Agents Behar and Reed gave me a real appreciation for what the Border Patrol does. But the overall impression of a giant fence that divides countries, families, businesses, and economics, especially when it is reinforced with concertina wire, it kind of felt like a prison wall.
Agent Reed used the metaphor of a house. It's got a front door with a lock. Many houses have fences around them. But it struck me that we're not talking about private property. We're talking about countries where there are families.
You know, border security and immigration have been hot topics during the presidential campaign, just in case anyone didn't notice. I can assure you that in San Diego, a lot of people have noticed. And from that perspective, the presidential race is sparking unprecedented interest among Latino immigrants. I've got KPBS reporter Gene Guerrero with us. And Gene, you've got the next story on this Global Nation edition of The World. Every year, people become new citizens and vote, but this year you've seen a real spike.
Yes, exactly. I mean, every time there's a presidential election, you see an increase in the number of immigrants who are seeking citizenship applications. But this year, the interest has been huge. I mean, if you look at the numbers in immigrant-heavy communities here in San Diego County, such as Chula Vista, and compare them nationally, there's been a 40% increase in citizenship applications.
40%?
Yes, that's 40% comparing from fourth quarter of 2015, comparing that to fourth quarter of 2014. Nationally, it was only about 14%. So the difference is there's just so many immigrants, especially from Hispanic origins here, who are interested in voting this year.
And the answer to that, the explanation, is what you're going to tell us in your story. Let's hear it.
Eufrosina Frias de Martinez sits on her living room couch with her daughter Lucero. They're reviewing a list of more than 100 questions about American politics, like, when does the U.S. elect a president?
¿En qué mes votamos por un nuevo presidente?
Noviembre.
¿Noviembre?
Que es November.
Lucero just got home from California State University, San Marcos, where she takes a workshop called Cultivando Liderazgo, or Cultivating Leadership. It teaches students to prepare their parents and others for the U.S. citizenship test. Lucero's family came to the U.S. legally in 1999 from San Luis Potosí, Mexico. Her mom, Eufrosina, who's 66 now, has been eligible for citizenship for years. But it wasn't until a few months ago that she decided to take action. The reason? Donald Trump.
Ay, ese señor no sé, como que lo discrimina a todas las personas que somos hispanas.
She says she believes Trump discriminates against Hispanics. Eufrosina also doesn't speak English, so Lucero's helping her with the citizenship test in both languages. Some immigrants can take the citizenship test in their native language if they're over 50 and have been in the U.S. for more than 20 years. But since Eufrosina has only been here about 16 years, she has to show English fluency.
The Constitution.
The Constitution.
The Constitution.
Eufrosina isn't sure who she'll support in November. Just not Trump, with his plan to build a border wall and deport millions of immigrants. But making sure Eufrosina can vote is what drives the Cultivando Liderazgo workshops her daughter goes to.
¿Qué hace la rama legislativa? La rama legislativa hace leyes.
In one of the workshops, Arcela Núñez reviews what Congress does and how that shows up on the citizenship test. It's like a crash course in U.S. politics and history.
Identificación para votar.
Núñez, who also runs the National Latino Research Center, says efforts like this are needed here in San Diego, where Latinos make up more than a third of the population, but still don't vote at high numbers. Núñez does add, though, that Trump is changing that.
Trump is definitely a big factor that I think is really pushing people to think about what kind of government we want to have.
Many of the workshop students come from immigrant families and are bilingual, unlike their parents. So students learn the material and share the knowledge. Núñez is convinced that people are more likely to become citizens if they're encouraged by a relative. Lucero says she's confident her mom will become a citizen with her help.
When she was my age, she didn't have the opportunity to go to school, work, or just simply get an education. And I'm on that opposite, you know, side. I kind of want to give that back.
Eufrosina says she's excited about becoming a citizen. She says she wants to have a voice and a vote and is determined to nail the citizenship test. For The World, Gene Guerrero, San Diego.
Stick around for more stories from San Diego. Just ahead, students get a whole new kind of school lunch. I'm Marco Werman, and this is a special Global Nation edition of The World, coming to you from the studios of KPBS in San Diego. And being so close to Mexico, you might be tempted to think that diversity in the city is all about Latinos, but it goes beyond that. You can see one example of that at San Diego's Crawford High School. The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, went there. So this is just your usual public school cafeteria, huh?
Yeah. Well, question for you, Marco. What do you remember eating at school?
Well, it was kind of weird because I had just moved to North Carolina from New York, and they served hot dogs on Friday in the school cafeteria with coleslaw on top. And I was like, I'm from New York. We put sauerkraut and onions. What are you putting salad on this hot dog for? It was like going to another country.
Well, I went to high school in San Jose, California, and we got pizza and, of course, burritos.
Well, that's a mixed metaphor. So what are they serving at San Diego's Crawford High School?
Okay, warning, this story might make you a little hungry. They get a chili and lime seasoned halal chicken drumstick.
Wow,
yeah.
That sounds pretty darn good.
Yeah.
So a halal lunch, that's kind of unexpected. Let's hear your story about how that came about.
Jamal Muhammad remembers going to Crawford High and either being hungry a lot or feeling sick to his stomach and going to the nurse.
I remember days spending in the nurse room because my stomach ached because of something that I ate.
Muhammad is from Somalia. He came here as a child refugee in the late 90s, and American food was new to him. It wasn't halal, meaning meat and other food wasn't prepared according to Islamic law. But because Muhammad qualified for free lunch at school, like nearly all of his fellow students, he'd break religious rules and eat what was served.
I mean, sometimes I would take the burger and take out the meat.
Or
I would eat the chicken and my body would have a reaction to it mentally because what my body is consuming is not halal.
It took a while, but as San Diego's Muslim community grew, parents started asking schools for different food choices, noticing their kids were skipping lunch. Now, something new is on the menu at Crawford High. A chicken dish, a halal-friendly chili and lime-seasoned drumstick with rice.
I was kind of really, like, happy about it because it was like, wow, they're starting to care about, you know, everyone.
Faisa Muhammad is 17, a senior. Her parents are also from Somalia. She was once one of those kids skipping lunch.
I kind of didn't really eat that much. Yeah, like, I would just, like, skip days, kind of.
She and other students rallied for a halal lunch option, putting up signs around school that read, "Eat it or lose it," warning that the chicken would disappear as a lunch choice if nobody ate it. And it wasn't just Muslim students behind this. A mix of students joined in, including Guadalupe Barón, another senior. Her parents are from Mexico. She remembers talking to non-Muslim students here about the new chicken dish.
Yeah, at the beginning, since they didn't know what it was just like, oh, well, I'm not Muslim, so I'm not going to eat that. But with the presentations, I think it really helped because a lot of students got educated on what it was.
Gary Patel was also on board. He runs food services for San Diego Unified.
It's amazing what the students on the campus can do if it's something that they create, that's something they had to be a part of. They own it.
Patel also saw how a halal meat option took off at schools in heavily Muslim Dearborn, Michigan, and that switching up the menu was more than just offering something new to eat. It's about recognizing change.
It's really looking at, you know, what do the students want? It may be halal. It may be different Asian-type dishes. We have a large Hispanic student population that wants more Mexican food. We design for them because they're the customers.
During lunchtime, lines for the halal chicken are long. It looks and tastes delicious, and fewer students are skipping lunch now than before. Five elementary schools in San Diego have also taken up the halal lunch, and New York City is eyeing the program. But the chicken is still only served once a week. Other days, students wanting to eat halal can choose tofu salad or veggie chili. But something new is being developed. Fish tacos, also halal. For Muhammad, who went to Crawford High a decade ago, it's all progress. He jokes that he wishes he could do high school over again.
Like, the dynamics is way different than back in the day. So.
It feels like it would be easier?
It'd be much easier right now, yes. Back when I was growing up, every culture was a separate entity. Right now, there's a mix. Like, the youth from my culture, they have friends from different cultures. But when I was growing up, it was us. Them, very segregated.
Back when the idea of having something different for lunch seemed far away. For the world, Monica Campbell, San Diego.
Every day you'll find young people from San Diego crossing the border. Same goes for kids coming north from Mexico. And the thing is, they never know how long it's going to take to get across. The lines tend to be longer on the Mexican side, which is where we were last night in Tijuana. We spoke with some students waiting to cross back into the U.S., and they were waiting in what they said was an unusually long line. Here's what two of them told us.
My name is Jocelyn Flores. I'm 13 years old. We don't really cross that often, but we cross like every 3 months. because I study over there in San Diego, and I think it's like a better, not a better life, but I think it's like better over there to like study and like better than over here in Mexico.
Hi, my name is Ernesto Quiroz. I came here to Mexico to come to the doctor for my acne control. I come here because I guess it's a little bit cheaper. Me and my mom always come here just about every month for my acne. When you come earlier, it's like less than 5 minutes, but now I don't know how long it's going to be. I guess there's a lot of people trying to get over, I don't know for what reason, and it's a school night, so I have studies for tomorrow.
Two students we met at the border just south of here in Tijuana. Also in line last night waiting to cross was Adela Quiroz.
Sometimes we come Sundays just to come to Tijuana. My husband likes, I do too, just to go to the beach, to come and eat Mexican food. Last month we came, we crossed the border about 3 o'clock. We did only between 5 to 10 minutes. But today is a big long line.
A long line, but people seem to be patient, like this guy who says waiting in line is just part of his commute.
Yeah, my name is Ramos de la Rosa. I cross the border about once a week. Usually I try to leave at night to get a short line. I'll even stick around for a little bit and hang out just to make sure I'm not standing in line for too long. It can get pretty long. I mean, I've seen it's up to 1,000 people and 3 hours long. This will probably be it'll be less than half an hour. Well, at least until we get up into the building. That's another little wait, but we cross into the border in about probably half an hour.
Some of the people we met in line waiting to enter the U.S. at the world's busiest border crossing, San Ysidro, between San Diego, California, and Tijuana, Mexico. You're with The World, coming to you today from KPBS. I'm Marco Werman. For some people in Tijuana, Mexico, it's cheaper to buy a small prefab house in California and literally haul it over the border.
So this house was brought from the United States in two parts. In dos partes, this is.
Yes, in two parts. Find out why that is as a special border edition of The World continues from KPBS here in San Diego.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Today, though, we come to you from San Diego in the studios of our friends here at KPBS. We're here not far from the southern limits of the United States and the very busy San Ysidro border crossing into Mexico. With me all this hour is The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell. You know, Monica, you live between the Bay Area and Mexico City. Your mother came to the U.S. from Nicaragua. You've known this immigration story your whole life.
I have. My mom came to the United States in the late 60s after meeting my father in Central America. And the immigration story is a personal one, but now I follow it closer than ever. I see how people from all over the world come to the United States, all of the different circumstances that they face. I feel like I have a pretty good handle on how the immigration system affects people on the ground, but even still, there are stories that surprise me.
Right, and that's what this is about. It was in Tijuana where we met some people with a very strong link to the U.S. They have family here in the U.S. They fought in the U.S. military. Some were injured in battle. Some have PTSD, and they are all deportees and want to go back to the U.S. Right now, though, home and the people they also call family are at a place in Tijuana called The Bunker, the Deported Veteran Support House. Hector Barajas is the founder. He also served in the U.S. Army and was deported back to Mexico in 2004. Now, The Bunker's first line of support is as a shelter for vets who have nowhere else to go when they land back in Mexico.
So this is we're at The Bunker in Tijuana, Baja California, and this is we're going up the stairs right now. There's a bunch of names that you see on the wall. We don't have any lockers, but we separate these little...
It's just kind of like little cubby holes for the members of The Bunker.
Exactly. So how are you guys doing today? Everything's good?
Good. Need a beer.
How's everything going with you? Your mom, how's everybody?
My mom's okay. She just turned 90. She had a party last week.
Now, considering what some of the men who are supported here have seen, the bunker is a pretty relaxed place. Hector finds time to check in with the vets who show up at the little house that serves as HQ for the deported veterans. For many of them, like Antonio Romo Reyes, it's one of their reliable social routines. Antonio, or Tony, is 47. He was living in Los Angeles when he enlisted at the age of 19. Tony was deployed to Iraq for Operation Desert Storm.
You know, I was young. I was scared, but I said, I'm not going to die. So last phone call I made to my parents, I said, I'm going over there. And my dad just said, don't let yourself get killed.
Tony made it out alive, but even as he told me what he saw, it felt like even he had a hard time believing he came back in one piece.
I mean, you get there, you smell dead bodies, you know, burned. Yeah. We did kill a lot of them. We did. So coming back, I was not myself.
Tony says no one suggested therapy. He didn't even consider it. He found drugs instead and got addicted. He was homeless. His wife left him with their daughter. Tony ended up serving 7 years in federal prison on drug-related charges. And on his release, he was deported to Mexico.
I love the U.S. I love it. And I love the Marine Corps. Gosh, it was a dream job. But I know I went wrong. I was wrong in committing the criminal acts that I did. I was wrong in doing drugs. I should have got help. But, you know, I can't set time back.
Tony works three jobs sometimes, which means he doesn't have a lot of time to socialize, even at the bunker. He's pretty certain that his drug conviction means he will likely never be allowed back into the U.S. That is not the case for another bunker member, Daniel Torres. He's 30 and was born in Tijuana, but grew up in Salt Lake City. His father brought the family north, but then overstayed his work visa. So when Daniel turned 18, he was stuck. He couldn't work legally in the U.S., and he didn't want to move back to Tijuana.
I knew I wanted to do something, you know. I figured I didn't want to be just another Mexican taking somebody's job. I wanted to be able to say that I had done something for the country. I wanted to say that I had put in my time.
He wanted to become a Marine, but he had no birth certificate, so he got a fake one that stated he was born in the U.S. He served more than 3 years in the Marines. He was deployed to Iraq, saw action in Fallujah, and he was ready to re-up to go to Afghanistan, and he lost his wallet. When he tried to get his ID replaced, the military caught him in his lie. It put Daniel and the U.S. military in a very tricky position.
And because I had a good record, and I had letters of recommendation from all of my peers and all my chain of command, you know, everybody was like, no, we don't want to screw you over.
So he was given an honorable discharge and found himself still in the U.S., but with no way to work. He thought maybe he could join the French Foreign Legion. That didn't work out, but through a Kafka-esque series of errors, he ended up stuck in France, only to be deported to Mexico, figuring that it would be easy to get back to the U.S. from there. He's been back in Tijuana now for almost 5 years. In that time, he's been studying to get a law degree, and Daniel hopes he will someday be practicing law in the U.S. because he may be the first deported veteran to be given U.S. citizenship.
It looks good. Like, the lawyer and everybody has been telling me that I have really high chances of getting citizenship, American citizenship.
If that does happen, Hector Barajas, who founded the bunker, will get a lot of the credit.
We got to take care of our people, our family, while we're here. You know, we can't wait until they're in the prisons and or after they commit suicide. We got to take care of our veterans while they're here with us and when they come back.
Things are looking up somewhat for Hector Barajas to eventually get citizenship. He also worries that for many of those vets, change may come too late. Bardis Vakili is a lawyer with the task force of the American Civil Liberties Union working on the cases of these vets who've been deported. What is the basis of your argument that they should be readmitted to the U.S.?
It's pretty simple. All of these gentlemen were lawful permanent residents when they entered the military. They all have long ties to the United States and families here, and they served and defended this country honorably. It shouldn't be much more complicated than that. They should be entitled to a fair shake in the immigration system.
I mean, every one of these cases is unique, but with two of the cases we heard about, there was drug trafficking, there were firearms involved. Anyone with a green card would be deported. So why should these men specifically be given citizenship?
You make a good point that these laws apply equally to everybody. It's not just veterans that get caught up in the immigration system when they commit crimes. These veterans are just another example of how immigration laws, when they're blanketly enforced and enforced with such a heavy hand end up stripping people from their families and sending them out of the country for sometimes for life.
Does that mean it's going to be hard to make this case because they're just like everybody else?
I think that's the case. Because they serve the United States, they do generate some sympathy from points of view that may not be generally pro-immigrant. But the fact is the law is very much stacked against them. It is a very heavy-handed immigration law that we live under.
I mean, the legal system in the U.S. Does not seem to be especially forgiving of U.S. citizens who have served and then, you know, go off the rails post-combat, maybe commit crimes. Are you at all confident that the U.S. legal system will be simpatico with these men?
If we can get them back in the country and get them back into some kind of legal status, you know, most of these men have begun to turn their lives around. They recognize the need for services that weren't available to them when they first got out of the military in the first place. With the growing recognition in this country of the needs of veterans upon their return to the United States, we're hopeful that those services will be available.
I was actually surprised to learn that you can enlist in the U.S. Armed Forces with just a green card.
That's correct. Yeah, you take an oath to the United States when you enlist, but lawful permanent residents who are residing here permanently are allowed to serve this country.
Isn't the idea, though, that if you do serve and you're not a citizen, you get expedited citizenship as a result of enlisting?
Yes, there is a path to citizenship that is a little bit more quick for people that have served and been discharged honorably. With a lot of these men, some of them just thought they were citizens. There was no service there to explain to them. You actually have to go through an application process.
Yeah, I was going to ask, why did these men not seek out citizenship when they got back?
So we're talking about veterans from any number of eras, Vietnam veterans, Desert Storm veterans, and even more recent veterans. Some of them were told, enter the military and you'll become a U.S. citizen, and they thought that was it. They took an oath to the country and that was it. Many did apply for U.S. citizenship, but because of the nature of being deployed or being transferred for training in a number of places, the application never found them again. If they were called for interviews, they never got the notice, and so then they missed interviews. And so again, they thought they were citizens until, upon committing a crime, serving their time, they thought they're being released to their families. They instead get transferred to immigration holding.
And how common is it that non-citizens who serve do get that expedited citizenship, do follow up?
These days, it's much more common. There are people working within the military that take great pains to advise folks now of their eligibility and try to encourage them to apply early in their deployments so that the paperwork follows them.
Right. But for these men, that's too late, obviously.
It's too late for all of these men, yeah.
Do you have a sense of how large this community is?
We've talked to men all over the globe from India, South America, Canada. I've talked to a couple guys from Haiti and Jamaica. There's no tracking of military veterans that have been deported, so we're relying very much on word of mouth and these networks that have sprouted up. At times, I feel like we've just hit the tip of the iceberg.
And personally, Bardas, why do you do this work?
These veterans were separated from their families. I do immigrants' rights work in general because the immigration system that we currently live under strips people from their families, good, hardworking people that have contributed to their country, from their families, and they're left with no recourse. And these veterans are just a natural, or just a subset of a lot of people that are caught up in this immigration system unfairly.
Bardas Vakili, an ACLU lawyer here in San Diego, representing some of the men we met at the bunker in Tijuana. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Marco.
The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, is here with me at KPBS, and she's also been talking to people on the other side of the U.S.-Mexico border in Tijuana. One of them is a Mexican artist whose inspiration begins physically at home.
So this house was brought from the United States in two parts, in dos partes, dices.
It was back in 1984 when Ingrid Hernandez was just a kid. Her house, like several on her block in Tijuana, came from across the border. It was cheaper, and still can be, to buy a small, unwanted home in California and haul it here. But to do that, some houses have to be split in half to fit on a flatbed truck, and neighbors have to make room for the trucks on narrow Mexican streets.
En las noches que están solas las calles, le piden a los vecinos que quiten los autos de la calle.
So she's saying that it's really typical at night here to ask the neighbors to get their cars out of the way so that a trailer can come up on the street with a house on the back of it.
Inside, the house has a characteristic 80s feel.
Toda la casa tenía estuco, pero nosotros hicimos esto hace poco.
This is the kind of stucco house that my house, where I grew up in California, we had the ceiling. This is taking me back to my own house. In California.
Si te das cuenta, la casa está
The house was also plopped down the wrong way, the only way it would fit on her family's small plot of land. So the front of the house actually looks into a neighbor's wall, while the side of the house faces the street. And it's so close to Tijuana's airport that the planes overhead make it shake. Hernandez's imported home also inspired her artistic work today, documenting neighborhoods in Tijuana. Like this one on the side of a freeway. It's called New Hope, a bit of a stretch. It's in a rough area just a few miles from the border. Homes and small shops are cobbled together from secondhand pieces of houses from the U.S. Hernandez stops in front of one house and points at its door.
Este material es interesante porque esto se llama madera comprimida.
This door is made out of particle board, but it's sort of got two materials going on here. Half of it is made from particle board, and the other half is made from fiberglass. This was probably found in a dump and then used to create this door.
Y obviamente tienen otro uso originalmente, ¿no?
This is something that obviously had another life, but now is being repurposed as a front door.
We also meet Marcelino, a young guy who lives here. He's building a small mechanic shop next to his home. He'll use old wooden beams from the U.S. and sheets of plywood. They're stamped with Made in Canada.
Venden así como paredes, ya que hay trailers que desbaratan así, venden las paredes.
He says he bought the material at a nearby shop that sells discarded goods like this for cheap. The Canadian plywood was supposedly rejected for some defect and ended up here. A small white pickup rolls up, blasting music out of its rooftop speakers. The tortilla seller. Before we leave, Hernandez, the artist, points out one last thing. A tiny house, like many here, made from U.S.-style garage doors.
Van a traer una puerta de Estados Unidos a Tijuana.
She says the doors are from the U.S. and sold in Tijuana as walls. Some still have their latches, locks, and handles on them, a reminder of something that lived one way in the United States and another here in Mexico.
Marco Werman back here in the studios of KPBS in San Diego. Monica, that was a side of the story I was not expecting. I was with you on that assignment, especially where I learned that whole houses come across the border to be used in Mexico.
Right. It shows how the U.S. and Mexico are connected. We hear a lot about the fence. We hear a lot about keeping these borders between the two countries really tight. But everybody in Mexico has ties to the U.S. And I think that's why we're seeing this debate over immigration get so heated. It's not abstract for millions of people in our country. It's about how people live their lives every day.
And we know that the immigration issue is not going away anytime soon, not with the presidential race at full tilt. And you, Monica, and the Global Nation desk will be keeping the stories coming.
Yep, back and forth across the border, looking at how people from countries all over the world come to the United States. It's going to be a very interesting year.
The world's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, thank you so much for being with us on the show today and for helping us see this part of our world.
You're welcome, Marco.
Just ahead, I go back to Tijuana to hear what happened to a musical mix of norteño and techno here on The World, coming to you today from KPBS in San Diego. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman at the San Ysidro border crossing. Let's go one more time to Tijuana, Mexico. The reason I've come back for one more hit of life in Tijuana is this music. This is the creation of Roberto Mendoza. We met some 15 years ago when he was part of the Nortec Collective. Nortec as in norteño, the music of northern Mexico, and techno. So, Roberto, good to see you again. Just remind us what the original impulse of the whole Nortec Collective was.
Well, we all were like these kids, like DJs, and being much into electronic music. And we came to a point where we wanted to make something unique and something of our own. And we just looked elsewhere and saw, like, different geographical places where they have their unique sound. And you look at Germany, where electronic music came from, they have like this minimal techno that's very, very minimal but with melody, and you know that it came from there. Or you look to England and to the ghettos of London, you know about drum and bass. And you look to even to Brazil, and you know like baile funk and all those things. And then we always had this music that it was like the norteño and the banda that we had heard the whole time. It was just like put it all together, and that's what we did with the North Collective.
So why here in Tijuana? Was it the presence of high-tech factories and the traditional life here that made this fusion more evident to you?
You know what? Tijuana has had a great musical history because, like, the first punk bands from Latin America were from Tijuana. The first, like, blues Spanish-speaking bands in Latin America and Spain were from Tijuana. And this is because of the influence of the United States, of course. So electronic music was the same thing. We have this electronic music influence from radio stations in San Diego. And I think that was part of the thing that got us on board to make what we were doing.
Tell us where we are right now. There's a very little artistic, old building with many different shops and galleries and boutiques. What's happening here?
When I look for a place that we could see like the old Tijuana and the new Tijuana, there was no thinking real, because Pasaje Rodriguez is like the place where you can see like the new generation taking over the city.
And that's where we are now.
That's where we are right now. And this is interesting because Avenida Revolución, the one outside.
That's the main drag of Tijuana.
For ages has been like the tourist spot where you get all the kids from San Diego to have in and drink and whatever. But when the big cartels began their fight with the police here, everyone just fled. And there was a big campaign in California to not come to Tijuana. So Tijuana began to fall apart economically, right? But the new generations of Tijuanians began to take over the places that began to be left. And instead of like having like, let's open a bar, they open a small galleria or a small coffee house or a small library. And best of all, it's like there's a big boom of foodies and culinary happening in Tijuana. So that's very important right now. And the microbreweries are like blossoming like crazy. So right now, I think it's a great moment to be in Tijuana.
Roberto Mendoza, a former member of the Norte Collective in Tijuana. Some other former members of the collective just got back from South by Southwest. They were there for the Interactive Conference. The music portion of South by is now underway, and tonight there's a showcase devoted to musicians from Cuba, which is obviously not along the border here in the U.S. Southwest, but Cuba will be in the news big time next week when President Obama heads there. The lineup tonight at the Cuba Showcase is killer. Five of the island's hottest performers are on the bill, and it's not the kind of mambo, old-school stuff we think of when we think Cuba. Musician Nathan Thornburg is presenting the bands.
One of the acts I'm most excited about is Telmari Diaz, who came into Cuban music in a very unusual route. She was actually a student of language and started doing spoken word and evolved into actually one of the most well-known and exciting hip-hop acts in Cuban music.
No quiero despertar con flores y sin primavera. Anda el bebo aborotado y mis palabras son el río que no llega hasta tu mar. Parecen cansar, parecen cansar.
That was Pa' Que Vuelva by Telmari Diaz. She's collaborated a lot with, who we're also bringing out on stage tonight, Kelvis Ochoa. He is, to me, one of the finest examples of the fact that Cuba, for all of its seeming isolation, has really had a tremendous amount of diverse influences. You can really hear the African influence, particularly West African music, in the songs that Kelvis has, along with like deep American rock and roll roots and traditional Cuban styles. You put that into one package, and this big guy with flaming red hair, incredible personality, a love for life, and just this voice that is just so capable of melting everybody in a crowd, and you have Kelvis Ochoa, who, of whom there are not two in this world.
Tengo un recuerdo aquí en mi corazón, pongo de una rumba buena que se está formando.
marca mi destino como el callejón, pasos y aguaceros, voces que se van sumando. Oye, oh, yeah.
Traigo vino.
Oye, oh, yeah, de la Rioja del camino.
So that was Kelvis Ochoa, whose music I first heard in 1999. I had lived in Cuba and was playing as a musician there, and it was illegal for me to be in the country. So to contemplate, not only can people move more freely between the countries, but President Obama is going to Cuba. All these Cubans are coming to South By tonight. I think it's a really an amazing time to get that essence of the island and try to bring it to the United States.
Ese sentimiento que me ha regalado la cuna de la raza, mami, el conocimiento.
Nathan Thornburg of the website Roads and Kingdoms. He'll be presenting the Sounds of Cuba Showcase at South by Southwest in Austin tonight. President Obama's trip to Cuba starts on Sunday. On Monday, we'll have another special edition of The World focusing on Cuba and Obama's historic visit. We'll hear from Havana and from Miami, from supporters and critics of the president's opening to the island, and from right here on the West Coast. That's all coming up on Monday right here on The World. It's time now to wrap up this edition of the show. A huge thank you to KPBS here in San Diego for their engineering support and for opening the doors to their studios today. From KPBS and from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.